I think we have some people here for the Zappa. Let's see. Who's that? Is that Bert or Roxy? I just unmuted you. Waiting for you to say something.
Yes, it's me.
Okay, good. And this could be Bert. Is that you, Bert?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Hi, Bob.
What I've just played, you know, you're the best yes man, Bert. What I just played was awesome, right?
Of course. But it's not just me the yes man. It's just recognizing what's the content there, Bob.
Yeah, the you get it's defining what we sort of know. It's defining better what we know. How the big farmers run around trying to imitate the RNA drops or the REMAG. And maybe Ian had said that in passing, but we got him. He told us that. The way he said it is very nice and concise, if you noticed.
Yeah.
Right? He was grand-man doing
this. There's a mystery landscape and the things that, for example, made Charles de Lubitz go to study for 15 years the Temple of Men after he was a mathematician and a chemist.
Right.
I have something
about him.
That there are the compounds that they know what they're made of, but they cannot be replicated like all these human substances. Blood,
like
the cow's milk. Brain. It's, cannot be synthesized.
Right.
So
it's cow's milk.
That there is the non-physical, like in all this work of art in the cathedrals that cannot be reproduced. That person, like the glasses in the cathedrals and some sculptures and many, many works that are anomalies, because that's the mystery landscape working with these persons, with the alchemists repeating the same experiment until they got gold and they didn't know why. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. That's the proof of the non-physical, and that's how they cannot reproduce the drops, because they need the non-physical, and this is the thing with this thunder, the last thunder.
Yeah.
That's why it's not going to create another body like the other thunders. This environment is different because this is the non-physical acting, and we're going to talk about that.
Right. Now, unfortunately, Bert, you're coming in late and not getting to talk to Ion, right?
Yes. I called in last week. I'm calling in later in the week. Well, I called in last week, Bob, but I was in the queue, but everyone else was kind of in the queue later in the morning. Your time.
Oh, you can do the morning. You can be on time.
Yeah, I called
for that.
Back, but the queue was kind of large. Yeah.
Yeah, and also because you come in as anonymous, and there are like four anonymouses there, and I don't know who they are, but I can check. But that's a bit inhibiting. But if I know you're coming as anonymous, I'll look for you. Yeah, because you're way behind in getting your questions in, right? You should have some questions.
I'm just
for
1 week off
now.
Actually, I'm one just week, 1 week off. I just missed Ian last week. I had some questions the week before that I... Yeah.
Oh, you got in. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You got in. All right.
Yes.
So what ideas are you coming up with? We sort of like flow into the Zappa thing here or just slip in somehow, but do you have something you want to say about what you've experienced, learned, or something?
Yeah, last week Ion said something that sent me into the LaRouche Quadrant. I've been circling the LaRouche Quadrant for like last month, just going on his site and seeing what they're posting. And there's been quite a lot of activity. The normal activity about the British government is the number one enemy, a lot of those things. But Ion said last week that LaRouche is a double.
Yes, he's dead.
Did you hear that?
The original LaRouche is not here. Yes,
yeah.
The original guy is dead. And we
so
now
I
you missed
and,
it. Hey, we got that explained tonight. I got Ian to explain with you. He brought it up or something. He explained what the double, why there's a double, and what it's doing. So basically, it's keeping the LaRouche meme going. Someone wants the LaRouche meme out there that the Queen's going up her butt and causing a problem. Somebody could be someone in the Pentagon, you know, some other empire. And so they keep LaRouche going because he's very articulate on that theme. He's not necessarily correct, but he certainly knows the names. If you want to find out about the – there's nobody else writing about the Martin family. St. Martin, he's been doing it for decades, you know. You never heard of the St. Martin family listening to Alex Jones or whoever else you might have listened to, any black guru. Who was that guy? Steve Coffrey or something, that guy, that paranoid guy who
– Coakley.
In the conspiracy
Coakley.
Stuff. They're not, Steve Coakley, they're not talking about this, so you got to give LaRouche credit about finding the Martin family, St. Martin oligarchy, and tracking it back. That's what's good about LaRouche. You'll find the names that one can find if you're paranoid. To get to find out what they're really doing, what's the St. Martin really about, you got to go through ION. You know, I was an expert on the LaRouche stuff, and I had experience of what he was talking about personally. I knew the people because I worked for them, so I would notice that he would, eventually find out. But we got a whole new level when ION came on about what was happening historically. But anyway, so what do you find? What are you noticing about LaRouche? Yes, he's dead, and they keep the meme going.
Yes. So what I did is I went into the archive and listened to an hour of Dr. Beters about the synthetic, robotoids. And that just blew me
the
away.
Organic robotoids.
I listened to an hour of it. The organic robotoids.
Yes.
It just blew me away because there were a lot of other names dropped by Dr. Beter as far as who is actually robotoids. And it was mind-blowing, actually. That was,
right. And
was
that's
May 1979,
40 years ago.
What I listened to. Yes.
Almost 40 years ago, that stuff. Now, what you have here, you have the Bolsheviks in the Pentagon created organic robotoids. And the Rockefeller-Moscow Native Russian Alliance against the Bolsheviks created what was called the synthetics. There's two kinds. And or I get it in reverse. There were two kinds. I can't remember which one produced which. You know, the Rockefellers might have produced the organic robotoids. So, and they're not clones. I mean, Beter laid out the as much as he could, layman precision in science, explained how they were made.
Yes.
And when he did that...
Quite a few.
When he did that, just like me joining ION, he lost a lot of friends. Nobody would believe it, and they thought he'd gone nuts. But he stuck to it, and that's in 79, and he went another 3 years of making recordings. Showing how certain people would be replaced and what we would call doubles put in, but they were synthetic or manufactured doubles. That was the way the elites that were fighting could do it. They didn't have to keep the doubles going. They didn't have to keep doing that in the 80s and 90s because media imagery took over, and everybody was so involved with the media, you just had to have an actor like Reagan. But in that period before the 80s, you know, global theater media extravaganza, the media could still monitor what was going on, and so they had to put in physical synthetics, physical human-made doubles that kept breaking. Did you hear the part where, you know, the Jimmy Carter guy would kept fucking breaking and stumbling?
Yes. 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 Sometimes he would look young, and sometimes he would look really old and haggard. And same thing with his wife. That was amazing to hear. Really, really mind-boggling. But with ION here, it's normal.
And people would say, "Oh, anybody could alter photographs." But here's what's interesting: Zappa, to bring it into Zappa, was talking about organic robotoids in the conclusion of Cat Beefheart versus the Grunt People in the 1969 version. Remember that the main characters became these machinic things that fell apart. So he actually was doing the robotoid, and if human thought creates things and human words, then he helped create robotoids if you can't find it in science fiction. But the way he presented it was more like the way Beter was talking about it. So that's where Zappa created the idea, and then 10 years later it showed up.
Yes.
Yeah, this is really beautiful because we are going to talk about the lab and the crazy scientist and how
the laboratory,
this is a reflection,
right,
of the environment conditioning.
Yes, I mean, he has an Uncle Meat in 1969. Uncle Meat, the government laid off government scientist, is creating he's taking human beings, Ruben the Jets, this doo-wop group from the 50s in Mexico, and he puts a spray up their nose and it expands their brains, what he called nasal drone mechanism. It sounds like a Beter tape, and then they float over
like
the population. What'd you say, Rossi?
It sounds like one of your products.
Yeah, sounds like one of our products, Nasal Mist, that's right. Yeah, it's a good point. He's predicting the altering of the cells in Ruben and the Jets. Awesome. Okay, that's neat. Now back to, so Bert, okay, you did Beter, and what else?
And then I, that really just had me really, like, freaking out. So I went and listened to a Frank interview. And it was very interesting. It was back in the 90s when he was very different from his earlier interviews.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the person was asked certain questions and got some background. But I also found that Frank dug Albert Einstein. I found that out.
Yeah.
He liked his hair. He liked his hair.
Yeah.
And also that... and he found out that he heard something that made him like Albert Einstein, which was unique, is that he heard that Albert Einstein got out of an important meeting to go listen to, or go watch his favorite something, Time for Beanie,
yes,
television show.
Yeah,
that's
some TV
what,
show, yeah.
Some TV show. So Frank enjoyed it. But I also, what turned it with Frank in this interview is that this was in the 90s, early 90s, and he said that he got his news time. He did a lot of news download. He listened to the Christian Science Monitor, and then he talked about the Sykes-Picot agreement,
yes,
after World War II. And that, I had no idea that.
No,
one. Reading on that.
I think it's World War One. It's a dividing up of the Middle East into the fake countries like Iraq and that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was
after World One.
He went on to, yes, how he disliked politicians. He just talked about how he disliked politicians, and
right,
and the Sykes-Picot agreement came up.
It was like he was a politician of sensibility, and he thought politicians were doing a lousy job being politicians. He knew they had to be practical,
yes,
but the quality, it's like he criticized rock bands. They weren't doing great music. They were missing the opportunity. So he had to go into politics to improve the quality of politics.
Right. Then also, I see where...
How do you spell that? Pico Sykes?
Yeah, Sykes.
I want to get the
Sykes.
Right.
Sykes.
Yeah.
Pico.
That's an interesting. When I was... you know, you see, this is where I read Beter 10 years later, and I remember it's in the play, though I didn't have the total script, but he had pictures of the robots in Uncle Meat, the booklet. So I go, oh, there's Zappa, and there's Beter. You can see my mind was sort of, oh, look, they're kind of echoing each other. That's how it started, how I started to create what Ein calls the holy offices, or what I call holy offices. So,
yeah.
So I'd be reading LaRouche about the Pico-Sykes agreement, Sykes-Picot, they call it, and... then Frank would bring it up. Now, he wasn't reading LaRouche. He found it through his own sources, or maybe I mentioned it to him or something. But that would be interesting where Zappa, who didn't like LaRouche, would be saying that, would be making the same political point. He says, look, this is a crazy world. It's created by the British government, a fake world, and that's who's at war, and we don't want to get involved with these fake nations. So he had the same view as LaRouche for a moment there. You know, that's what I found interesting, that I didn't know he'd do that, so that it would start to overlap. It was all Club 22, you know, they start to overlap in their commentary.
Yes.
And so right now, we're
very
doing this
controversial.
What?
Go ahead. No, he said something very controversial. Is that he He said that they should have a second part for Mount Rushmore. And Joseph McCarthy, J. Edgar Hoover, and Nixon and Reagan should be on the other part of Mount Rushmore.
The bad guys. The bad mountain.
The bad guys. Yes.
Yeah. And he had the right guys. He had Hoover up there. You know, he knew who the bad icons were. It says here in the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the negotiation of the treaty occurred between November 15 and March 16. The agreement was signed on May 16, 1916, and it was exposed to the public in the Manchester Guardian on November 26, 1917. So it's at the end of World War One, or just near the end. See, so it's not World War II. And then the 30s, if you read Dr. Beter, the 30s was a battle between the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, or you could say Europe and North America, over controlling these fake divisions. And part of it's creating Israel. And that's what World War II was, the different Western powers taking advantage of what they'd artificially carved up. That led to World War II.
Yes.
According to Beter. But what Ion tells us is that World War II was instigated by the Nazis because they started making incredible technology and they could take over the world. That was their motive. And they did get ahead of everybody for a while. Okay, so what we did, okay, so was there something else? We did Sykes-Picot, the overlapping. What was your next? What did Frank say? Very controversial?
That they should have a second part of Mount Rushmore.
Oh, yeah, right.
J. Edgar Hoover, because they had the most impact on what he said that they had the most impact of what America is today.
Is.
At the time.
What it became.
Speaking. Is.
Not Paul McCartney,
became,
Joe McCarthy. Not McCartney, McCarthy.
Joe McCarthy, yes.
Yeah, McCarthy, who was this alcoholic, you know, rascal. Who just ruined many people's lives. That's what's interesting in reading Susie Rotolo, Dylan's major muse and early girlfriend. She had communist parents, and they were subject to the blacklist. You know, her friends in New York, her communist party kid friends all had parents, you know, in trouble, and they really had to be careful what they said. If they said a couple normal things in school, they would be censored, kicked out of school. You know, very restricting. Which reminds me, Carolyn, is Susie Rotolo Jewish? What do you think?
I don't think so. She's Italian.
Right, but there's Italian Jews. But I was talking to Murray about it yesterday, and I looked it up, and she was born in the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital, but I don't know if she was Jewish.
Mm.
That's what we'll have to check that out. Mm. Anyways, you don't instinctively remember.
Mm. Yeah, no. Vaguely I remember, because then she found out Dylan was Jewish.
Well, is she Jewish? Are you saying she's Jewish?
Maybe.
As Murray said, all communists were Jewish back in the 50s, so he thinks
good
she was
point.
Jewish. Let's see. So here we are with Zappa, and what's the next thing to say, Bert? What's next on the script?
The next thing is that Frank concluded that interview with, they asked him how would he address people in the year 3000? And he said that in the year 3000, he would have to probably talk in language of bacteria. So he said some weird, he said some really, he just said something like, "Mumaka laka woo out ti, ha ya ya ya." Took a drag of
he
a cigarette.
People would be
cigarette smoke out.
He blew cigarette smoke out as part of it.
Yes, at the end. Yes.
He blew the cigarette smoke to indicate talking to bacteria.
Well, actually, he said something sounded like angel speak. Really?
Yeah.
He took a drag of a cigarette and blew the smoke out, and that was the end of his message to the people in the year 3000.
Okay. Are you saying that the smoke blowing was how he would communicate? That was part of it?
No, that was the conclusion. He did say something in angel speak, and then he took a drag of the cigarette and blew the smoke out at the end after he finished mumbling in bacteria land.
and they're not necessarily connected. They might be connected, the two actions.
Might be connected.
Yeah. But the point is he saying that only bacteria would be left?
Well, there would be some people, but mainly would be. He said it just may be some slugs and bacteria, and that if there are any people around, he would probably have to talk to them in bacteria language.
They would rule. The bacteria would dominate.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, now you take that idea. Ian says, we're not for humans. We don't like you guys being limited to being human. So to the degree that Zappa is not thinking, he's thinking that the humans aren't going to make it. That's accurate. Not exactly like what he may not mean what, if he heard Ian say it, he may not mean what Ian meant, but we can take Zappa's words and fit it into predicting Ian. He's saying the same thing. There's going to be no humans here as we know them. So that's resonant.
Yes.
do you have something to say, Roxy, at this point? Or are we just listening to Bert?
Yes, I think the gesture and the talking were both related because we communicate with chemistries, with electron pulses, and not only with the speech, with many other things, like you said, you have this transpersonal way of communication, which is,
right,
is much more complex than just the speech. There are electromagnetic fields, force fields.
Yeah. Right. Now, here's where I first noticed it. In the fall of 1970, Jimi Hendrix had died in September, and Janis Joplin died a few weeks later in October. And CBC interviewed Zappa the end of October into November about this. You know, what was his statements of these rock gods dying? And what was really struck me, because I had not seen him do this before, he had no self-consciousness about smoking. So he's being interviewed, and all the time he was making these smoke rings. You know, he was a really cool, practiced smoker. He could make smoke signals while talking. You know what I mean? So he was making all these funny, weird smoke signals while he was talking about. He basically said, I don't know if they asked him if they were murdered. He just said they, he didn't say much. He just said it was unfortunate and they had not much remorse. He didn't go into a big eulogy. He just sort of accepted it and made his smoke signals. So then, within a year, he's writing this amazing laying out of conceptual continuity and this thing that's called, Hey, Snazzy Executive, this is what we do. And we read that interview where he explains the conceptual continuity. Well, he talks about the mystery laboratory is in a sea of pins and needles that fill up most of Europe and most of the Atlantic Ocean. And if you go and you find one little needle among the billions of needles, in there you'll see somebody in a studio and they make a wink, they make a gesture. He made a big deal out of the gesture that was made hidden away in this mountain of needles. And so that shows the significant gesture that Roxy's pointing. He would do that when smoking. So he was giving out smoke signals for something, for maybe beef art. You know, they had certain ways of making smoke rings. They created a smoke language. He could have been saying that to his buddies while being interviewed. But he does have the secret gesture in this scenario of huge continents covered with needles, and you got to find the needle in the haystack where the secret action of the programming of the environment is being done by Zappa and his buddies, and it includes a certain wink or eyeball gesture.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, because that was his conducting tune. He had his own personal repertoire
language
of hand signs and
hand tables,
gestures.
Yeah.
And
well, you know, that's where I got the title of my play.
Initiate school, get all this.
What did you say? He initiates what?
Yeah, the musicians that work with him who understood the different types of some.
Right.
Some were not only to play, but to start doing some movements, to dance, to.
Right, improvise. Yeah. And that footage that we found on YouTube, recorded in the middle of December 1970, I'd never seen that before. The band is playing, but they're all staring at Frank, real intently, watching the signals. They actually look rigid. They don't look. They're not sitting relaxed playing like a regular band. They're all tightly, body language tight, watching the hand. You know, really paying attention. They were like using I. The I was overemphasized. Whereas, as when I jammed with Beefheart, he said, "Stop looking at me, Bob. You're supposed to be listening, not looking." But in Zappa's band, you fucking had to look.
Yes, because especially for contemporary music, the notation, the traditional notation, was never enough. So there has been a lot of experimentation on how to notate things that are going on. For example, effects that the musicians do with their instruments or electronic generated things or all types of alteration. And usually the composer develops his own symbols and then explains to the musicians this means this and this and this and this. But for example, Marshall McLuhan said one of the main innovations of John Cage were his writings, because not his music, but his writings. And he had to do a lot of explaining of his concepts, because some of his pieces, for example, he's playing silence, or he's playing with plants, and it might look silly, but he had to do a lot of conceptual work and explaining, and then the people would get what he was doing, but. It's like the music is both the writings, the speech.
Yes, it's all the media.
The frequency.
It's not
expanded.
Just limited to the ear. He's including synesthesia, multimedia, which is what Phineas Wake was, and John Cage was a big student of McLuhan and James Joyce. So it's interesting that Zappa, he just says he was influenced by John Cage, but you don't hear what he took from Cage. Because if he took a lot, he would know more about McLuhan than he indicated to me. But I don't think he read much of Cage.
Yes, I think...
I
actually think he knew and read much more than he recognized.
Led on.
Because, for example, he usually says, oh, I don't know what's going on. I don't listen to anybody.
Right.
But there are some programs in which he was working as a DJ. And the variety is... This is from pop, rock, world music, classic, experimental.
Yeah.
So he knows what's really going on. He's really listening to many environments. And also when he's talking, he's very informed about everything. So he will say, I don't read, I don't listen to anything. But he really did.
There was one interview.
Traveling.
Now, listen to this, Roxy. So on April 25th, 1975, I'm going to go to Nassau Coliseum, which is the home of the New York Rangers on Long Island, and I'm going to see Zappa and Beefheart playing together. They basically never had played together, but Beefheart was lost. His band wasn't doing anything, so he asked Frank if he could play with him, and Frank took him on. Apparently, Beefheart auditioned in 74, 75, and he failed. Then he came back. Frank gave him a second chance, and then he made the band. So it's going to be a great concert with Beefheart and Zappa, the guys that I originally met in 58. So they're back together. So on the way out in the Grand Central Station, I see this obscure music magazine, Zappa's on the cover, and has an interview or a story, an article on him. So I'm reading it on the subway, and it's the first time anybody got this information out. The guy, whoever he was like maybe a writer, he revealed all the books that Frank was reading. Thomas Mann, I think it was, which is about Germany. Zappa was always reading about Germany. Thomas Pynchon, all these books that Zappa denied he knew anything about, this guy got him to admit it somehow. Which, you know, in Zappa's plan, he says, I'm going to put it out in one interview. This obscure guy in an obscure newspaper, I'll let it be said there, but I'm not going to say it in the more well-known media. So I get out there, and I meet his manager, and his manager saw that and said, oh, that looks pretty good. Can I borrow that? I said, sure. So I lent him the magazine before the concert. And then I end up backstage with Frank and Beefheart and all this. And then after the concert, I go to the hotel where they're going to hang out, and I meet the manager, and I ask him for the magazine back. And he looks at me and says, you're a fucking asshole. You never gave me a magazine. I said, yes, I did. You just like 3 hours ago, 4 hours ago. He said, no, you didn't. And if you keep, get the fuck out of here. He tried to kick me out of the hotel because I wanted the magazine back. So this guy was a real creep, and he didn't last long in the Zappa organization. He was fired or quit shortly after that, but he was such a liar. So I didn't have it, so I had to buy it. When I was up all night, and I'm going back to Grand Central Station about 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, the next morning, and I went into the same store and bought my second copy because he had stolen it. So that happened with that article, but it was an important article. You know, I had to buy it twice. And that guy is not talked about. He's considered, I think his name was Marty something. He's considered a jerk. So that's who had Frank, was managing Frank at that point. And he didn't like, he just wanted to lie. He probably realized it was a good interview and just couldn't be bothered to give it back to me. Okay, so that's a side thing. That's where, you're right, Roxy. He did read. And we hear it in the Ike Willis thing. He, in hanging out in Frank's lab in the 80s, Frank had all kinds of books there, scientific manuals. He was keeping up on all kinds of things, like Leonardo da Vinci. But he used to say, any private information about me is not relevant to the public. He knew he had a certain image, a certain role to play. He basically was being an ear guy against the pink ear, or he was being a tactile, visual, kinetic guy versus the ear. You know, you could fit into the conflicts and competitions in Finnegan's Wake and in McLuhan, it's eye versus ear. He was somewhere in that battle, publicly. You know, he was taking a sensory position. This movie for your ears. So out of that, that's 75, 76, that's when I invented, and I got on stage that night and did the air guitar. So right after that, I was probably inspired by the whole thing, and that's how I invented my 33-act play called Hand Signals for the Blind. You can't see my hand signals. Hmm. Hand signals for the blind. That's what I'm sure it was influenced by Zappa. So, carry on. Next idea, Bert. Mm-hmm. What's the next thing you were inspired by?
Also, speaking of hand signals, in this interview, Frank also elaborated on his dislike for politicians because they were really stiff in their hand movement gestures. He said their hands—they were like robots, programmed robots with their hand gestures and their helmet hair and everything. So he really expressed a disdain for all politicians
because they were repressed. They were very suppressed people, neurotic, you know, trying to fit back into the past visual space mode, and he knew that wasn't healthy for a person. So he would mock it. Now, here, what's great about this, Bert, I've never heard any Zappa fans talk about this aspect or these interviews. This is why we're unique. We're talking about parts of Frank that's never been said before. It's there to be noticed. And I want to say, my intelligence knew this fucking idiotic manager, he was threatening, if I made one more complaint, he would kick me out. And I didn't want to get kicked out, so I just ignored, you know, so okay. You can have it. And I walked away, and then I got to stay in the hotel and had a great night. But I was smart enough not to make an issue out of it. The guy blatantly stole it. It wasn't that valuable. I could get another one, but I suppressed my ego and was cool. That's the way you survive, you know, when to fucking calm down. You know what I mean? The guy had it all.
Yeah.
He ruled that floor of the hotel. If I would irritate him one more point, I almost had to say, you're fucking amazing. You're a really good criminal. You know, that's where I'm impressed with you. That's a nice job. You fooled me. You know, I had to almost be like that. just a little sidebar lesson. Don't be an egomaniac if it's, the point's not important.
Yeah, don't push too hard.
Yeah, in a situation that you want to be in, like there was this young, ugly kid hanging around there, and he'd come to see Beefheart, and he was so self-conscious. When I'm talking to Beefheart, I invite him over. He wouldn't come over and talk to Beefheart, though that's why he was there. He was so nervous, shy, and everything. And he just had a loser. He was a loser. He should have come over and talked and gotten over his shyness, but he just huddled in the distance and watched. So he missed out on it. And I was talking to him for like half an hour before and being friendly to him. And then I brought him in to talk to Beaver, and he wouldn't come in. He missed the opportunity of his life. Maybe he was fucking FBI. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe he was spying on some level. Yeah. Yeah, maybe try to poison Beefheart.
Like you.
Yes, like I did. So, okay, next point. Before we go into the lab thing, what else did you notice, Bert?
One more item, which I found very interesting. This is with the beginning of Frank's dislike for politicians. He was talking about when he was young in the 50s, because the person asked him about what was happening in the 50s, and Frank was amazed at how the Dwight Eisenhower's golf game was covered in the newspapers. He said it was really ridiculous. He found it ridiculous that the only thing that the newspapers had on the headline was Dwight Eisenhower. And he said he remembered one day where it was the last straw for him, is that he was reading through the newspaper. On the front page, they had how great Eisenhower's golf game was. And he said on the back page, in a real small section, they had a scientist in Florida discovers life. And Frank said it was about they discovered amino acids, and they applied a small electric charge to the amino acid and created a living cell. And Frank said it was so amazing, something so important that he thought was on the back page, but something so irrelevant as the president's golf game is on the page, it really just made him really just not like politics.
Right. So here's what you do. Zap is a kid. He's taught to read. So he's, as a kid growing up, he thinks reading is important. It's his novelty, his talent. He can read. And he's learning and studying, and he suspects, no, he assumes that the guys making the newspapers are responsible and interested in the truth or in knowledge and presenting the news to him properly. And when he finds out that the guys editing are fucking being stupid or liars or hiding up things, he's going to say, what the fuck's the point in reading? Why should I read? You know what I mean? When they're not serious about what they're presenting to me. That would be his first awakening to the visual bias, or to his own visual bias, that is not necessary. Why read? If a public medium like that. That's a medium awakening. Just like Frank used to talk about, certain kids are religious or mystical. They have a certain bent for the non-physical or spiritual. And if the Pope or somebody or priests start acting corrupt in front of a kid like that, the kid feels really violated. That happened to Roxy when she went to the convent, and the nuns were creeps. Here she was dedicating her life to being a nun, and found out that they were fucking assholes. That'll fuck you up. And that's what Frank was saying. This will fuck up a kid. It'll make them mean or rebellious.
And you end up in this crazy cult.
Where? In the crazy cult of Ion. That's right. Good point there, yes. You end up listening to the blasphemous Bob and Ion. That's right. But we are correcting. It's always been that way. You end up in a cult, thousands of years. The cult was a ripoff, you know, from Rasputin to the Rosicrucians, all the cults. We're the first cult that lives up to the standards of grace. And you are going to pay. It's going to pay off. So we're not like the other cults. But the
one other note.
Yeah, I just want to say Frank understood his own. He was a kid like that. He believed in whatever mysticism or church or something was. It's like believing in being a decent person, and then you find out that nobody is being good seriously. You know what I mean? It's all fake. That interrupts someone who wants to be good or to feel that way, or to have a state of grace. And he knew that about himself, and he knew about certain kids. So he had a good bit of wisdom there when he said that. So what were you going to say, Bert?
So another point that I found really interesting, because I remember hearing and reading that Frank was interested in explosives. But in this interview, he said that they asked him about the atomic bomb, and he said the atomic bomb really impressed him. But when he was 5 or 6 years old, he got the thought. He said, well, if you have a bomb and you have the head, why not have more than one bomb? So then he thought about it, wrote up the plans when he was 5 or 6 years old, and gave it to his father to create bomb, a better bomb.
Yeah. That's his, now, Ion says, to Ben Watson on September 2nd, 2009, that Frank was always trying with his art to destroy people's perceptions and to blow people up.
Yeah.
And he says in Life magazine that the Mother's Invention are like a useful household cleaner, like ammonia, whatever ammonia household cleaners were called. He names himself as a little bomb to clean up the house. But that was his first... composition was his bomb idea. And what did you say? What did he a bomb with a head? What was it you were saying?
Yeah, he just thought, because in the missile, they said in the missile you have one bomb, but he thought when he was five or six, he said, why not put more than one bomb
in the missile
head? So that you have...
oh, okay.
In the missile, so that you have a larger reaction. And he said, so he created the plans for MX missile when he was five or six years old and gave it to his father. But he said his father didn't have the right connections to get the bomb built.
No, but that is so symbolic. You've hit on an important part of the conceptual continuity. He knew he started being a composer when he was 6 years old. He composed his first thing to blow up the public mind. You know, physical blowing up, but then he did a lot with the chemical laboratory, kid laboratory thing in those years.
Yeah.
So the lab was an important point. He was a little scientist.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like this natural genius, this little junior Leonardo da Vinci, is very involved as soon as he can be. It's like the millennial kids. He's ready to participate in society and contribute because he's got some basic ability, you know? We call it a genius. But he's a little genius wishing to contribute. And then he finds out they're all corrupt, and he gets pissed off.
Yes.
And his brother goes into that a lot in his book, the new book about Frank reacting to corrupt teachers and principals. It really rubbed in his face, you know. And it's almost like reality said, we got to have a really mad guy who will really try to blow up the music world. And, you know, we got to have an end environment to the music world. And so they created Frank, non-physical created Frank, which was probably me, the Ofenel Project. And you got to get somebody to blow up the teen music world, kill ugly radio. More stuff never said. You have to realize no one has ever said this about Frank, what we're saying. Granted, it would sound pretty crazy, but we're able to quote it.
He had the intuition of the blast, blasting the environment to...
Right. It is great when reading about his impression. Right, but it's great reading about his impression. I'm glad people did interviews to get what he thought of what was happening. He goes on about how creepy McCarthy was. He said, I knew that guy was fucked up. There was something creepy about him, you know.
Yeah. He said he smelt like it. He smelt him.
Yeah. And you wonder, what's a little genius, what's he seeing? Well, we do have a few interviews where he's describing what he saw as a kid. Which is good. Let's just see. I'm just going to look to see what they're saying on the chat line. Kensington Cat. Now, he's a guy, Scott, who you can hear on my CKLN shows back in the late 80s. Scott writes, when Frank recited the talking asshole, that was the part from William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, for Giorno poetry sessions. Now, Giorno refers to John Giorno, and John Giorno was a good friend of Jim, I just forget his name now, and Jim, who was the Canadian ambassador to everybody and a special friend of the Dalai Lama because he preserved the microfiche of the Dalai Lama when the Dalai Lama was living in India after they left Tibet in 59 and it was all melting away. Jim, he introduced Mir to Carolyn, and later... an early version of our Coldplay was found behind our Mir patent, the guy who invented it, Walter Fishman. So there's a whole incredible thing, and Jim was part of that. And Jim, even though he's a straight ambassador, he was very involved with Gurdjieff, and he was a good friend of John Giorno. And when Carolyn bumped into John Giorno, he said to Carolyn was telling him what she was doing and that she was a friend of Jim. He says, well, you people should give that away. give Muir away. And the person who owned the Muir, the widow of the guy who invented it, would never give it away. But in retrospect, if they had not schemed so much to figure out how to get Steve, the guy who owns Forbes magazine, Steve Forbes, he was interested in this technology because he had to help Elizabeth Taylor. And Elizabeth Taylor came involved in, and one of the Forbes people had a gay lover who had this thing, and the Muir was being used on him. So it's all intertwined there. And Jim knew these people. So in retrospect, if they were trying to get, Walter Fishman was trying to get a celebrity to support Muir and get publicity that way. But the Evergreens told me, well, Walter should just give it away. And they never did. But John Giorno said that as an old beat poet. He was one of the first lovers of Andy Warhol. And Empire, is it Sleeping, the long Warhol movie where the guys, they film him sleeping for 8 hours? That was John Giorno. So he knew Jim, and when he heard about Muir, he said, give it away. So that was interesting. And so Scott is bringing up the Giorno Poetry Sessions, which is an album of the celebration of William Burroughs in November 1978. It was the week of Jonestown. I think Jonestown was discussed during the convention. And a lot of the Severo Latrange, he was there. A lot of the Pomo people were there. And Zappa was there. So this is what Scott's referring to. When Frank recited the talking asshole for the Giorno Poetry Sessions, he talked about not reading. That's right. He said something about he doesn't read much or something. Yeah, that sounds familiar. He did play that up, but you have to understand Frank was an actor. He was taking an iconic position as an anti-environment to other environmental assumptions and memes. But it wasn't Frank's personal life. It wasn't his personal opinion. And that's the impersonal method of poetry that T.S. Eliot championed. Just like there's no Marshall McLuhan in Marshall McLuhan's writings. It is speech itself talking. So Frank was allowing music to speak. You get that? He was allowing the instruments to talk.
Interesting idea.
Yeah.
Speech itself talking. That's very interesting.
Right. The talking asshole. I say Ion's a talking hologram. When we're irritated with Ion, we can say the talking asshole hologram. When you get pissed off at Ion, you quote Burroughs.
Yeah.
But Ion's so on top of it, we could start bringing up Burroughs, and he'll start quoting the talking asshole section. That's the kind of joke he would do. So Scott just gave me a flower. He's happy to hear us talking about and responding to his post. But that's how intertwined it is. Years later, we got the talking asshole and the record, famous records that John Giorno put out. And Giorno was intimately involved with Dobbstown through Jim, whatever Jim's last name was. Right? There it is.
Right.
And it was interesting that Jonestown happened. Zappa made a song about Jonestown shortly after that, and Burroughs talked about Jonestown. A lot of these poets and that were intrigued by the cult of Jonestown. And I used to, in the 80s, when at CKLN, the Generation Xer people, that the young kids there who were programmers, they all would play the Jonestown screaming and yelling as they got murdered drinking the Kool-Aid. That generation was fascinated by the Jonestown recordings. All right, next issue. Is there anything else on there? Oh, I want to tell you guys, last week we arrived at the 122 hours, that special number. We have done, before the show started, 122 hours. awesome production. Now, is there anything else? Okay, now we're going to sit back and let Roxy give her lecture on the lab.
No.
Okay. You have to shut up for a while.
It's perfect. Everything is related. You don't have to shut up.
Yes. Actually, no, but you'll have to say a few words.
Beautiful.
You have to lay out the idea. It's your idea, so you're going to state it. Lab.
Well,
L-A-B. Let me tell you this, Roxy. L is the 12th letter. A is the first letter, and B is 2. So it's 12, 12. L is 12. A and B becomes 1, 2, 12. And that becomes 2, 22. So the three letters make an awesome 22 mimic resonant thing. It's like 2, 22 is 44. So it's a good bunch. It's a good combination of letters, L, A, B.
Wow.
If you're superstitious about numbers.
No, but the thing is, I was reading War and Peace in the Global Village, and all these topics are in there.
Yeah.
And,
that's what's intriguing. Frank, was it they're concerned about the same issues as the McLuhan was?
Yeah,
you know,
and
they,
you
they
and...
The
There are many things in there that I read before, but I couldn't get really the meaning until now in this moment. Yes, because there is a lot of talk about the lab, the code breakers, the seer, and I understood what McLuhan is really talking about and saying.
Not like a year ago.
A year ago
you read it, and it wasn't very interesting to you.
Well, it's very interesting, but not at the same level of... It didn't have the same impact.
Right, right.
Like, I really understand.
Good you reread it. That's why I tell everybody, you don't have to go running around looking for new books. You just reread the books I already told you to read. Reread them. You will find them different a year later. If you've been growing or learning. Like, you don't have War and Peace in Global Village, do you, Bert?
No, I do not. No, I do not. I have a lot of others, but not that one. Also, I need to get that one and the Laws of Media. I was thinking about that last week. Because you made some reference to the Laws of Media, and it's pretty curious. Makes me curious.
Right. So you've got...
Because,
you know,
actually, McLuhan is the... explaining the present situation and why most people is going to commit suicide.
Right, exactly. And so McLuhan never said that, but William Irwin Thompson said it. But Thompson talked that he's the McLuhanite that would say it's going to be mass suicide, mass death. You know, McLuhan wouldn't say that. But I've got his private letters here. I should read some of his private letters to Mary. He's a nut privately. He says, Mary, we're going to get blown up any day now. You know, they talk about how cool he is publicly, but privately he's very upset that she's contemplating divorce, and he's really going down hard on her, trying to scare the shit out of her to cool it, because the managers of society are not in control. They're dealing with awesome forces that they can't control, and we're going to have a problem here. We're all going to get killed. He's saying that in his private letters to her. But anyways, the...
This is how these weird connections are made. And, for example, he also says the seer is the person who can't see connection of patterns that for other people have no relation. There is no connection between these patterns. And because he has this disability, he can explain what's going on to the tribe, and he has the plans to heal them and to help them. I think that's Bob doing the chart. Like, he could see a lot of connections that nobody else could see.
Well, I'll tell you that I was just going to say
then,
McLuhan, and listen to this, Roxy. McLuhan would see that the similarity between the newspaper page and a Picasso painting and a Karl Orff musical composition or a Schoenberg or something, he would go across the cultural spectrum from sport to politics to education to art, and he would see there's an underlying decentralized tactile mosaic. Well, that's what he did. He looked into the outer kingdom. What I did is I said, wait a minute, there's different people doing what McLuhan was doing, noticing the hidden ground. And that's Zappa, LaRouche, McLuhan, and Thompson, and Croker. So they were doing what McLuhan was doing, seeing the hidden ground, updating it from past McLuhan, and then I notice these guys being similar. So I didn't notice general patterns. I could read McLuhan for the general patterns out there. But the patterns among these particular people were the predicting of ion. That's what the chart is. It's finding the people who unwittingly were predicting the new technology. That's a bit different from McLuhan.
Yeah, predicting, and also the whole work, as you have been explaining, it's also the way we could understand how this is possible, because all these ideas, for example, Caroline was reading to us the review of War and Peace, and the reviews were like, he must
that?
Have
do
been
I,
an
privately,
acid
when did Carol do that? Which Carol?
Yes,
the other
when
night,
you,
or?
You called very early in the morning.
Right, and she read the review of something, yes, and saw the pattern.
Of the War and Peace in the Global Village, and the review was...
Right.
The critics were saying he must have been taking LSD. It's
you
very
right.
interesting, but nobody
understand
can understand
it.
That. or they thought it was just crazy and funny, but at the time, because of some of the ideas, made seem really, really absurd and crazy. Like, the thing that for me linked to Zappa is because he said when there is satellites and we go to the moon, there is no more separation between first nature and the second nature.
Right.
And the Earth becomes the art form and everything can be programmed. For people
yes.
who are like, what? He's
yes.
crazy. How can nature, the planet, be programmed? He's like a crazy
yeah.
scientist. For me, the proof that Zappa really knew is because he named his daughter Moon Unit.
Yes.
And everybody makes fun of that because how would you call your daughter Moon Unit? He's like, he on drugs also. Because he saw the importance of that event and the big change in our conception. Of
yes,
the Earth becoming the art form.
The art form. The
and the Earth.
Now look at this. In accounting, in the music industry, they measure sales, and the royalty check for the musician is called units. How many units do you sell? That was the term. I don't know if it was the term in the 60s, but it was like an economic term. At least later he talked about it, how the accountants took over. But he recognized the moon and the Earth were becoming a concentration camp within the effect of the hidden ground of satellites. And he has his lab designed as a satellite in early 60s when everybody was looking at the beginning of the moon program. So he's doing, just like when Andy Warhol, who painted his lab silver, his factory silver, so it looked like a NASA, you know, a rocket ship, they both understood and were trying to describe the effect of the satellite environment, which McLuhan was, you know, being very precise about. And so Zappa was, so then he has Cap'n Beefheart and the Grunt People. It's all about going to the moon. This absurd one guy, yeah. the individual, grabbing the rocket and somehow getting there and bypassing the corporate effort of NASA. Or NASA.
Like a little,
which is what Frank was
poor
doing.
Man.
Yeah.
A huge
yes.
thing.
And Frank,
poor Bob.
Yeah, that's what Frank was saying. A giant step for Frank and a big step for Bob. That's what Frank was hijacking the corporate enterprise of the satellite industry. And, yeah, that's the way to talk about it.
Yes, and another thing is McLuhan talks a lot about the Pavlov experiments with the dogs. That
yeah, Pavlov.
He said, okay, he's not discovering anything because the environments are labs and we have been conditioned
already
by the environment forever. So he
right.
doesn't see why everybody's saying Pavlov is discovering
significant
conditioned
yeah,
reflexes.
Bakun is calling the bluff of Pavlov's discovery. Who's making significance out of it? And then he points out how different cultures interpret it differently. So how can you have a unified field theory of science? You know, have some kind of knowledge system that everybody's agreeing on, that we've arrived at some law or truth. They couldn't even determine what...
It's what Ion is saying. Science is impossible.
Right.
Because to repeat the experiment, you have to have the lab always in the same conditions forever, and the environment cannot be forever the same.
Right.
There is a lot of things going on.
And the Russians, being less hypnotized by visual space, noticed the ground of visual hypnosis in the lab setup. Said, wait a minute, we're conditioning the dogs and watching whether we can condition or not, but we're being conditioned by the lab itself. That's what they discovered. Whereas the detached European, they were so detached from the visual effect of the printing press, they didn't think anything could affect them because they were living in a visually biased, the eye is neutral, it's the only sense that can be detached, so people were collectively becoming this great sense of detachment and the environment wasn't affecting them. That's why they become indifferent to nature. And they, shockingly, holy shit, the dog got conditioned. You mean to tell me the environment can affect me? That was the European interpretation. The shock that we were, and McLuhan extended to, Europeans discovering they'd been a robot for a couple hundred years. The environment was affecting
them. Yes, and that's where what Berg was talking about comes in. It's like we are all these robotoids and the zombies and the sonambules. And,
right.
Yeah.
And then McLuhan was saying the literate man who discovers he's a robot in the electric age, because the electric age helps him see the previous environment. So Pavlov showed them visual space as it was disappearing under electric decentralized conditions. So we actually were in the present not becoming a robot anymore. The electric environment was decentralizing mortar, so people weren't in a hierarchy bureaucracy that led to, you know, 200-300 years of conditioned robotic behavior. So Pavlov points out there's conditioning, but it's an obsolete insight. It's about the past. You have to realize that we're not being conditioned by the new environment in the robot way. We're becoming discarnate super angels. And Dave Wirser used to say that, I don't know if awareness said it, but he'd say that the Russians, they discovered, or he discovered the principle that when a people wakes up and they've been brainwashed, they cannot be brainwashed again. So if you were brainwashed by visual space for 200 or 300 years under print and early industrial conditions, mechanical hardware, when the electric age freed you from, subliminally, the conditioning of visual space, you could never be conditioned by visual space again. And it was no longer there. That's part of the message of Finnegan's Awake. It's a technical statement. It's like Joyce is describing the real meaning of the Pavlov experiment beyond Pavlov's two versions. And that's what McLuhan's writing about.
Nobody knew that. Mirror, because
this is the first time, Bert, that anybody reading... Roxy, just a minute. I want to compliment you. This is the first time I've ever heard anybody in the McLuhan world point out the significance of those pages in War and Peace and Global Village. No one's ever noticed that. I've mentioned it to people, but they never. Wow. Kirchhoff never brings it up. It's an incredible part of that book. So what were you saying, Roxy?
Yes, like you said, everybody was... then doing theories about modern man being a robot, and like Frank was noticing this politician acting as a politician, dressing himself as a politician and doing what politicians are supposed to do. And that bothered Zappa because he saw people were just following rules of behavior, of codes. And he always tried in his personal life to explore alternatives, and maybe his children didn't like that because he was too unorthodox. and he was open about his polygamy and all these things, but he saw his life as a lab in which he was experimenting in the environment, trying to create an anti-environment to what he saw was an aggression of people, the ads and the mainstream condition, your taste, the way you behave. And that's why he hated romantic songs, because
right.
he saw that was a big conditioner of how you're supposed to feel and behave and
right.
what you're supposed to think love is. That doesn't have anything to do with force field.
Right.
And confuses
his
people.
His main question? It what? Confuses?
Yeah.
What'd you say?
People think those are like recipes and they're all false premise. And
right. Now, what is the major song, the major philosophical probe on Freak Out, the first album? It's a song called Who Are the Brain Police? Who is conditioning who? That was his question. And then Bob Marshall asked him 22 years later, album was in 66, 22 years later, October 88, Bob Marshall says, have you figured out who the brain police are? He says, no, I'm not ready to pronounce who the brain police are. He was still working on it 22 years later. And that's important because he, as a literate Westerner, in some ways was old-fashioned and didn't believe he could be conditioned. That's a literate person won't be, especially a naive, semi-literate person who doesn't know the full effects of literacy. You have to be a sophisticated writer almost. You have to be detached from the writing phenomenon. But if you still admire writers, you're going to be impressed, and you're not going to look at the full effects of it. So Zappa was, sometime I look at him, he was an guy who hoiked up visual values, but he knew they were limited somehow. So then he wondered, well, how much are we a robot? And he'd go back and forth about, well, if you're aware, you can't be conditioned. But many people are being conditioned, so I will tell them what they're being conditioned by. He didn't understand how the conditioning was on such a big scale, that's McLuhan's knowledge, that his issue was a Don Quixote going after windmills, as one of the biographies of Zappa calls him, the electronic Don Quixote. At least he was honest about the fact he hadn't figured it out yet. See, that's a step.
Yeah.
Pause the step. He doesn't have a cliche response. Oh, we're not robots, or we are robots. It was actually in between, and the electric age did free people from being a robot. And Frank knew that he could be free in many ways as a composer, and what he could get away with in his records that other previous composers couldn't do. So he knew there was a good part to the environment of the 60s and 70s. It allowed him to happen.
Yes, because as McLuhan also says in... I don't know.
Was that a hunger pang?
Fell asleep. Somebody fell asleep. But,
okay.
Yeah, here McLuhan has this message to the fish. Like, and he says the fish has no idea of his environment. He cannot see that he's in water.
No, but the book ends with a message. Roxy, the book ends with a message to the fish, fresh out of the water.
Yes, but first there is the message to the fish, and he explains how people had no idea of what really is going on and what's an environment, and they just see the rearview mirror.
No, but here, let me give you a sophisticated McLuhan point here. He said in the mid-60s that it's very hard to condition people anymore because too many environments are being made and turned over and replaced by another environment. So you start to get involved in the 50s in black and white TV and getting hypnotized by you. Then the space satellites happen. Then computers happen in the 60s. Then the global theater. And then color TV. The human is not in an environment long enough to get conditioned by the characteristics of that environment. So McLuhan was saying, we're not being conditioned anymore. Modern man or postmodern man was not conditioned. That was a very subtle point that McLuhan was making, because everybody said, oh, he's writing history as if we're all technologically determined. We're all robots all the way through history. Yes, that's what's happened. But the environment had arrived at such a rapid series of innovations in the 60s that we weren't being conditioned to form any particular hypnotized culture anymore. That was a breakthrough, and nobody got that sort of positive message.
No, on the contrary, there were a lot of theories about how men were being conditioned by psychologists and all this.
Right. All this 1984 paranoia. 1984, you know, George Orwell paranoia was not the situation.
Yeah.
Now, in 1984, when the new anti-nuclear protest started in 82, 83, 84, it got really big. Sue Boehm was part of it. She, on the June 25th, 1982 protest, she was down in New York with millions of people, part of that. Now, they were knee-jerk responding to rearview mirror image, but the point was, by 1984, people weren't sure that it was exactly like Orwell laid out. So de Kirchhoff, who was the co-director of the McLuhan Center after McLuhan died, he got to write a few op-eds in the New York Times and got some attention because he was saying McLuhan, who nobody wanted to hear about in 1984, was way more relevant than Orwell. And so he said Harold Innes ran circles around Marx and McLuhan ran circles around Freud. That's what he says in that article. It's a good, pretty good understanding of the meaning of McLuhan. But it got him a bit of notoriety. The some people, I think Mary McLuhan told me that Corinne was mad that de Kirchhoff was saying that the nuclear bomb wasn't so dangerous because it was an older environment. And the McLuhan family didn't understand Derek's sophisticated McLuhan's response to the Orwellian argument. Because most people, this is in the Star Wars period, people thought Reagan was going to blow up the world with Star Wars. They wanted as much protest against the bomb as possible. And Derek was saying, no, you're doing a rearview mirror response to the nuclear fear. So it was pretty good what he did. And it was the beginning, I mean, he was beginning to perceive that McLuhan was saying something totally different from Orwell and Huxley's Brave New World. Now, what I'm saying has never been said before in the McLuhan world or anywhere else, and Bert is smart enough when he hears it, he goes, wow, because he knows he's never heard this before and can get enough of it to realize what a great insight. What I just laid out, right, Bert?
We are drooling.
Yes, drooling. Yes. It's a huge pattern.
And then you see how that overlaps with Rai, the original programmer, the original cultural archetype. Even Thoth is like a Rai, creates separateness, saying, well, I'm an incendiary. These hoi polloi, stupid little people are not. The beginning of principalities and religion and specialness was obsolesced by the mid-60s by the technological can't hypnotize anybody, and that's why Rai returned essence. So I would say, holy shit, what De Worster's saying is what McLuhan's validating. Now, that was a connection no one would ever think of. They didn't know Worster. You have to realize how fucking unique my patterns were back then, and Roxy realized that. Like, oh, Bob's putting together things. We don't even know where he got this shit from. But that was a good example that Rai returning essence wasn't so crazy if you understood deeply what McLuhan was saying. And he said in Newsweek in 1966, Madison Avenue...
You cannot really get McLuhan without pop knowledge because
that's right.
Since I go to talks
exactly.
And they're specialists of POB and
Bruce Powell,
they're very
Bob Logan.
In their understanding, they're still talking about the global village and all these obsolete
and talking about conditioning.
We are
they're actually. Bob Logan's got another book about McLuhan out, and he's going to unwittingly explain the very message that McLuhan was not about, because he'll put it back into his Gutenberg humanist literate bias. But I wanted to say this. Why does McLuhan say in Newsweek, he's got the podium of a cover story, and he says Madison Avenue couldn't condition a mouse? Okay, he's talking about some kind of conditioning going on by the environments. Why would he say Madison Avenue doesn't condition a mouse? You have to figure that out. Wait a minute. You're telling us everybody's conditioned by Madison Avenue, and you're saying they don't know what they're doing. That's an important point. And, of course, Noah McLuhanite, Eric McLuhan, nobody I ever met ever brought that point up. I was the only one saying this music. I was writing. I was Ornette Coleman at the 5 spot, but in CKLN in 1987, 88, laying out this new free jazz of the mind. It had to be.
And the
there's no point
all...
going to school. I couldn't teach us in school, but they didn't allow professors to talk this way.
No, that connection to the non-physical, there is no way to learn
that's
this.
That's right.
There is no way to be a seer.
And Ion is coming forth. And Ion is saying, without Bob knowledge, you don't understand why Ion is so flippant about, you don't need to do yoga, you don't need to do acupuncture, you don't need to do homeopathy, you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
You are free. He's actually agreeing with McLuhan's point. That you can't condition humans anymore.
That was the part where I really got these epiphanies when he's talking about the code breakers.
Yes.
And how everything has been put in the environment, but this message was for this special person, and it was encrypted so that only the ones that are to get it can break the code.
Yes.
And
the test.
Among all these things is like you knew you selected the vortices, Lewis,
right,
and Joyce, and doing.
I found the right class to get tested in. I found the right which department should I go to get the most valuable, hardest test? I found the hardest department, the vortices, the ones that everybody avoided. They said they had evil brains. I went in that department, took the course, and passed it. Right? That's what you're saying.
Because people that were so brilliant, like Marx, and they tried to explain what happened, the whole history.
They were trying to explain Ra'i.
For example, production.
They were trying to explain Ra'i. And where did principalities
but
come from?
Their explanation is like trying to make milk, because there is something missing, and so it's partial. It's not complete.
Not complete.
And
it's almost like they were still victims. Roxy, they were still victims of the Dark Age, which was the effect of the printing press. You had to get 100 years past the death of Gutenberg Galaxy, which happened in the 19th century. Had to have 100 years later before Bob and Ion could show up, not making the literate mistake, which every thinker up to us made, because they still were book people in the end. They still unwittingly were fragmented. They hadn't seen through deeply the effect of the very thing they were proud of doing, which is being a writer. They're very proud that they could write books and think it out, you know? And that was the final subterfuge.
Yeah.
They didn't notice that. Joyce did. Joyce, the vortices started to notice it.
And many went into occult societies and to try to complete what they know.
They were oral seer. They knew the oral seer. The traditional seer was on to it. They knew there was something important about the action of being a seer. And McLuhan is explaining the seer process as a new kind of seer, revealing the new seership of the new symbolism, and he could analyze and know the creative process of the old-fashioned seers. He even knew he was a new kind of seer, but he could describe the tradition of seership, which these anthropologists and vortices were sort of hypnotized by. Joyce spent a lot of time interviewing Levi Brühl. Joyce had his favorite anthropologist. Pound had his. They each would go to an anthropologist and spend time with him and learn that knowledge. You know, so they knew that there was something about oral tactile culture that was important, and somehow that should be retrieved. They never got completely. Terence McKenna never got all the way. Tim Leary didn't get none of the New Age guys. John Lilly, Mr. Houston Smith, any of the people they have as intellectual seers in the psychedelic or counterculture movement got as far as McLuhan, and they never got as far as me, who went past McLuhan. And then the greatest seer of all. Sorry, I went on.
No.
Inspire me to explain this.
It's the topic. It's the only way we can understand what Ion is talking about you understanding the mystery landscape.
Right.
Or when you say things like, I am the greatest artist, the greatest scientist, and making the new on environment.
Yes.
People who has no idea of all these things may think you're just crazy and a megalomaniac. But
I'm just a nut.
No, that's
I am
your
the
conclusion
of the nut tradition.
So
40
wrong.
Years.
I am.
No.
How many years?
It's 40
How
years.
Many years?
Of,
40 years, that's right. 40
well,
years.
40 years in this awareness, lucidity, recollective
yeah,
lucidity,
yeah.
But
yeah.
In the no time, you were of an alcohol lab and you just created this very complex composition.
That's
and
right.
Now you are like
most
sort of remembering.
I see. I got some new insights. But Ayn said I was the new Moses. This is back in 2009. And I was going to lead the people to the roof of the Grand Wallet and we'd jump off the roof and go into another dimension like the Mayans did. But the Mayans failed to come back. We're going to come back. Bob have mastered it, so Bob will come back. Well, I'm realizing that was a metaphor then of leaping into this new dimension of communication, disappearing, coming back. That's what we're doing on payday and whatever else that we know we're doing, like the drops. It's actually I'm being the Moses that he predicted already. Metaphorically,
yeah.
I'm asking people to leap into the void and bring them back by, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Sunday.
Yes, and this archetype of the lab that is important for Frank Zappa and the crazy scientist.
Yeah, yeah, the crazy
the lab
scientist.
Yes,
is,
yeah.
Is like an expanded view of the lab. Is the environments we have created and the different thunders, the different medias that were changing our perception or cognition or chemistry. And many aspects of the environment, maybe the bonding of chemicals, maybe many things that were never even recognized because people could not see there is a relationship like what Diane said today, that people try to explain why volcanoes are erupting and this and that, and the causes they think it's not like that. Maybe you just... Talking now is going to create something that
yes.
has a scientific explanation, but is not the reason.
That's right. Let me explain what you're evoking. I went to a Zappa concert in the, October, November 77, with Matt Groening, the creator of Simpsons. And we were there for several months. As Carol was doing an elective at the UCLA Pain Control Clinic, which was offering effects from the Nixon's trip to China, acupuncture, and all these new Asian methods of medicine that were coalesced around the UC, University of California, Los Angeles, Pain Control Clinic. So Carol went and treated Laura Huxley, you know, Aldous Huxley's wife, her widow. So in those 2 months or so, yeah, 2 months, we had a lot of fun with Worcester and everybody, but and that's when I met Mary McLuhan at a demonstration of Captain Beefheart paintings. And so we go to this concert, and Zappa says at the beginning, well, I see the Hollywood elite is... knew all these people in the 60s. It was all part of the scene. I mean, he was the scene. He was the leader of the scene that Jack Nicholson and them, as crummy movie stars, B-level movie stars, they hadn't made it yet, would be hanging out around the charisma of Frank. So they'd be impressed with Frank. And then they become figures in the 70s when movies as a medium becomes the dominant rearview mirror period, the rearview mirror analog media retrieval, which is in the Croker quadrant, and you'll see that in my chart, 72 to 77. And movies become the main anti-environment for art and all the great movies made in the 70s. All those guys were watching Frank in 77. So he mockingly looks out and he says, I see all the Hollywood elites here. So several times I had conversations with Frank through the years where he would talk about the Hollywood elite and how he knew them all because they were all his puppies in 66, 67 when he was leading the entertainment stuff on Sunset Strip. And he was not impressed with any of them. They were crummy. No big deal. So he was in Hollywood, not hypnotized by Hollywood, and he was an anti-environment to the whole Hollywood scene, or the mixed corporate media, the entertainment military complex. So that was his audience. He was providing an anti-environment to all popular analog media, which were becoming archetypal in intensity as we moved into the actual Android meme, which was post-human. This is in 77, 80. And so when he has the government scientist is pissed off at the establishment, he's been laid off, Uncle Mead, and he's going to get back, it's a James Bond scenario. Every James Bond movie was some renegade scientist invented some new weapon, and James Bond had to stop the guy from taking
trying
over.
Trying to conquer
right?
the world.
Right. That's right, trying to conquer the world. So Frank... he could use sound, like Gurdjieff's octaves, as an anti-environment to the Hollywood visual pantheon. Movies, magazines, fashionable rock and roll guys that were based on visuality. He used the hidden sounds. It's like Hollywood was the subatomic particles, but the frequencies and tonalities below the subatomic particles that I talked about, it was the way Frank was critiquing the visual media and being an anti-environment on a level that nobody could perceive. So he was a maverick Uncle Meat, so that Dr. No and those different villains in the James Bond movies, they always got some hardware weapon, a particle beam thing or something. Frank's weapon was a fucking band. You know what I mean? He knew the real change is not in taking over the Pentagon. It was taking over the teenage rock and roll market. He knew where the real war was being fought. And so his Uncle Meat is in a different kind of lab. It's a sound lab.
Yes, and
so you're telling me to go on because you can tell by my breath that I'm going to say something important, so you're willing to hold off for a second for me to finish the wave I'm surfing, right? It's like an ear thing here.
Of course.
So just like he said he never read anything, he said he never fucking watched movies. He said, you know, in the 80s, there was 20 years of great movies. And he goes, well, I did see Eraserhead. I thought that was pretty good. He dismisses any other media because he's dealing with the subatomic frequencies that nobody knows that's what he's up. He's not impressed with any other visual thing. Or even kinetic. He does say this album is a movie for your ears. So he's mixing movie, kinetic space, visual space with acoustic tactile space. But he's in neither position. He's operating from what I call the corpus callosum tactile space of conditioning. So it's incredibly amazing to analyze the Zappa this way, which has never been done by anybody. Based on the vortices knowledge and other knowledge that I gathered together.
Yes, because why would you have this interest in this specific composer? There are many, many, many. But we are seeing that there are many aspects of what
I
he
would
was
read
doing.
Downbeat.
That,
I would read all the different magazines and the reviews of Zappa's albums to see if anybody was seeing in these university-level worlds of art sophistication, if they were seeing Frank, if they were noticing, and nobody did. Only Dave Wally. That's why I bonded with the first author of the first Zappa book was Dave Wally. He, a graduate of Yale, cultural critic, smart guy, he knew that Frank was on to something, wasn't sure what it is, and I knew it, and we were the only people in the world noticing it. They would just, you see these old articles, well, Frank's some weirdo that can't, he doesn't seem to be just a jazz guy. He's actually out there doing doo-wop. They couldn't figure him out. I don't think we ever saw anybody figure it out until the Bob Marshall interview came out. And everybody was amazed and called it the greatest interview when the internet started. We, in that interview, started to point out stuff of Frank that nobody realized. And then the biographers would use that. That's what give him So the biographies got a little better from the mid-90s and that on, but no one's got to this point.
The same thing happened to McLuhan. Many people say, oh, that's the guy that say the medium is the message. Oh, yes. And they think they talk about ads on TV, and that's it.
You have to see, from the late 60s to I'm talking about Zappa, LaRouche, and McLuhan. Thompson hadn't shown up, Croker was not, Beater not yet. But just take Zappa, McLuhan, LaRouche. I'd enter into a conversation in a bar or anywhere. I was considered a fucking idiot. I brought up the wrong people. I didn't look very smart. Like, they'd be talking about the Beatles or Jim Morrison and his lizard poetry, and I'd say some amazing stuff. They didn't know what it was. For 20 years, 67 to 87, till I get on the radio, I was a guy who kind of ruined the conversation, because why are you sitting among us? Obviously, Bob, you're into fucking teeny bopper shit. Zappa and McLuhan, they're not worthy of noticing. That's what they used to think. But I was so confident about what I was doing, I didn't mind that people didn't agree with it. I just kept on doing it, talking about it. Not meant nobody. I used to try to get Lester Bangs, the famous rock critic. He hated Zappa. I couldn't get these guys to take an interest in what was going on. I did it all through the 90s. I'd go to the Barnes & Noble. They'd bring some author in, some famous guy. He'd say a bunch of shit. I'd get up in the question period, bring in amazing insights, and I'd get sort of booed. You know? It's pretty amazing.
And you shout,
that I was
a why?
Yeah, why? It was like I was a walking anti-environment, showing how the population were a bunch of somnambulists. And either you fake dying, Bert, or die, you can go look at the cash records, and you can track what I'm talking about. You can watch my 15 years in New York and enjoy, you know, every other day Bob goes to Barnes & Noble or something, and you can watch what happens. It's all there for you to see. It's a great history. And then you have, on the radio, people calling in at CQN, Bob, sounds pretty good. I don't know what you're talking about, but it sounds like it might be real, Bob. You know, you get this puzzlement right there recorded in the audience 30 years ago. And if they could ever luckily find out what's happening now, they'd even be more shocked. You know, listening to Ion. You should hear, did you hear most of today? It was a pretty good session today, right, Roxy? Ion was talking every time. You should have heard him with Neufeld. Holy shit. What did you think of that, Roxy?
I heard that.
The telephone died, and I could not hear everything.
Okay, well, you definitely want to go back in the archives and hear it. But you heard it, Bert, right?
Yes, the exchange with Dave was amazing, with electronic and sound. It was that's something to re-listen to. That's really something to listen to, because it was really, they were bouncing back off, and Dave got really excited and hyper.
Right, and Dave got into issues, like core questions in his mind that he puzzles about. And, of course, none of us understood what they were talking about, right? We don't know the tech. I don't know the tech.
Right.
I don't think anybody there knows that technology that they were discussing. And whatever he brought up, Ion was right there, ready to supplement it, correct it, support it. But then got Dave all excited. So Dave had the conversation he's never had with anybody.
Yeah. It's fun to listen to.
Yes, and then...
Right.
And another thing that brings us to Zappa and somehow connects with the book... War and Peace in the Global Village.
Yeah.
It's Frank starts, like you said, shouting, freak out. And here, McLuhan starts by explaining how each thunder